Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes, my great producer. I just want to remind everyone that we actually Zoom this show on Monday afternoon, so if something should happen Monday night, you'll hear about it on Wednesday, I guess. And also, just to let you know that New Hampshire is, I don't know, are we lucky? Did we pull the short straw? I'm not sure how to describe it. But Donald Trump just announced that there will be a Trump rally in Portsmouth, New Hampshire on Saturday. Anyway, before we begin our show, you know what we do. We begin with the powerful testimony of someone who represents the greatest of patriotism, of love of country, of selflessness, of courage. It's the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I want to make sure that his words, his memory, and what he represents is in your head when you vote in November of 2020. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So, do I like polls? Yeah, yes and no. But sometimes some polls get me really excited. And this poll was like, oh God, please, please. Here was the title. Young people believe they can lead change in unprecedented election cycle. Joining us right now are two people who helped to work on this poll. They're from an organization known as CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts. It's a nonpartisan independent research organization focused on youth civic engagement in the United States. And I want to welcome to The Attitude Abby Kirsa and Christian Lundberg. Abby is the Director of Impact and Christian is an associate researcher. Thank you so much both for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I started my political career when I was 15. And I remember leafleting the Long Island Railroad in Hicksville, New York at 5:30 in the morning about a school bond vote. And we desperately needed this addition to our school because we've been living in temporary units forever. And I realized that if I didn't get involved, it wasn't enough for my parents to vote, that their daughter had to do it. And then I joined the Young Democrats. And then I founded the UN Club at Hicksville High School. So I started developing the political muscle at a very young age. And you know why I'm saying that, Abby. I can see your head shaking. And that's why this poll that you and Christian and CIRCLE have done is so exciting, because the nuggets of information you were able to glean from it are so important. So I'm not going to start with Abby. I'm going to start with you, Christian. And the top finding I thought was just so exciting, because I keep telling young people when I give speeches around the country that I'm passing the torch to them. And for whatever reason, it looks like, as you point out, they're seizing their power. So tell us a little bit about what that means from the polling information that you were able to glean.
Sure. So what we've seen, not just in 2020, but also in 2018 and over the past 4 years in particular, is a huge increase in the number of young people who are interested in not just the election, but in engaging in civic life more broadly. So young people have shown an increased interest in voting and making their voice heard in November, but they've also done a lot of things in between election cycles to demonstrate that they are engaged and motivated to participate in their communities and in politics at a local and a national level. So in our poll, we've seen that young people are attending marches and demonstrations at rates that we haven't seen before, certainly not in 2018 and 2016. They're trying to reach out to other young people to convince them to participate in elections through voting or through campaigning or volunteering. So young people overall in our poll have shown a huge increase in their awareness about the election and also their motivation to get involved in their communities and make change, both in terms of national politics, but also locally too.
So Abby, I know in 2018, we could sort of feel the surge. Actually, in 2016, we also began to feel it. I mean, whatever Bernie Sanders did, my old man friend from Vermont, he was able to inspire youth in a way that was really quite remarkable and exciting and magical. And it turned out that it wasn't a moment, that it was the beginning, I think, of a movement. So talk to me about this arc from 2016 to 2020, because what I find fascinating from your poll is not only that young people are getting more and more engaged, they're getting more and more involved in rallies and sort of external movement, but they actually see that they have the potential to be the change. That to me is so exciting, because that means they own it. They own it. Because if you see yourself as the potential switch to make change, then you're gonna wanna turn on that switch.
Yeah, thanks for framing it that way, Arnie. I mean, one of the things that has been really interesting about this dynamic between 2016 and 2020, like you alluded to, is the fact that there's this tension between young people and institutions. There's this tension between how fast can institutions move? How much can people create change, right? That's, you know, one of the reasons why young people voted for President Obama in 08 and 2012. And so I think, you know, we have had a few election cycles now where young people have really been at the forefront and in influencing what's been talked about, right? So in the 2016 election, we saw the incredible, as you mentioned, run by Senator Sanders with young people behind a lot of that, not only voting for Senator Sanders, but also in leadership positions and working on the campaign. And then in 2018, for tragic reasons, we saw more young people influencing the conversation about election cycles. And so, you know, due to the influence of young people organizing around gun violence prevention. And so I think one of the things that we've seen in the past couple of cycles and already this year is young people's leadership during an election cycle, bringing up the issues that they are working on and trying to influence candidates talking about those issues. And so that's one thread that I see through 2016 until now. And as you know, can see right now, just the amplification of the experiences and the leadership of Black youth across the country, you know, in, you know, things that have been happening for a long time, but are getting a lot more visibility finally.
So Christian, I have to tell you a story. So it's 2016. It is the day that Bernie Sanders is going to make his announcement and file for running for president in New Hampshire. And there was just an enormous crowd. I mean, it was just huge on the front of the State House. And I was walking home because I live about two or three blocks from the State House. And there were eight young men, a diverse group of young men, by the way, all probably under the age of 23. And they were so pumped and they were so excited and they saw me and they started talking to me and it was like this just amazing informed conversation. And I mean, I've been around political campaigns a long time. I've been around a lot of presidential campaigns, but I never saw a level of enthusiasm like this. And it just, I remember going home and almost wanting to cry because I'm like, please God, stick with it. Please God, stick with it. And what I get from the circle poll is that it is not only that they've stuck with it, but they understand not only that their role, but having not always been successful in 2016, not always been successful in 2018, they haven't been dissuaded that this isn't the way they need to go if they're going to produce the change. Like sometimes, you know, if you don't win, oh my God, Bernie didn't win. Oh, in 2018, some of my progressive candidates didn't win. But it turned out that didn't stop them And in an interesting way, the failure that we've seen from the pandemic has almost added to the inspiration of Black Lives Matter, of the gun violence, of the student debt. It sort of crystallized, I think, for them, a lot of the inequality and the injustice.
Absolutely. One of the really cool and important things about like engagement generally is that engagement begets engagement. Nobody is born a voter and nobody is born an activist. However, that is, as you said, Arnie, it is flexing a muscle. And once you build up that strength and once you practice being engaged and being active in movements or in politics or civic life, you tend to continue with that. So that's why we've seen that in 2016, a lot of the Sanders activists were also, and like the young people who are really in the camp of Bernie Sanders, continued that activism and continued that engagement in 2018 and beyond in electing a lot of progressive candidates. And so that's really cool to see, because once you provide young people with like entry points and ways to access the ecosystem of electoral engagement, young people will tend to continue that pattern and will tend to continue being engaged. And that's why we've seen in our polling data from 2016 to 2018 and 2020, a pretty linear increase of engagement through a whole host of different metrics. Yeah. So yes, absolutely.
And I mean, again, it's better, I always say it's better than drugs. You know, I mean, you can drink a case of beer, you can get high for an hour, but this in an interesting way is something you can do with others. It's something you can do socially and online. It's right. Something that isn't even destructive. It's building something. I mean, I always love, like, you know, building a wall in my backyard with stones, because each stone is a separate stone and what do you get? But after you put together 40 stones, you're going, oh my God, look at the wall I just made. And I see in a lot of ways that this level and this participation is like each one of us is sort of stepping back and looking at what we've done together. And what we've done together is such an incredible movement, which is so amazing. And Abby, one of the things I found fascinating is that you also asked them, obviously, because 2020 is the issue, which candidate they prefer. So talk to me a little bit about the Biden versus Trump and how the breakdown is with the young people that you are actually polling.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that I think we've alluded to is that sometimes it's issues that are driving young people, issues related to their everyday life. And so one of the things that we're seeing in this data about presidential candidate support is a little bit of a dislike for the current president amongst some youth, as well as sort of an ambivalence about the Democratic candidate. So we do see a 34-point gap in support for former Vice President Biden over President Trump. Now, that looks really different when you break it down by race. So for example, Asian American youth, 78% for Biden, Black youth, 73% for Biden. But when you look at white youth, it's much lower.
What is much lower? Tell me, I want the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Much lower is 52%.
Wow.
And so this actually mirrors, this is not new. This mirrors what we've known for several election cycles, which is white youth, many of whom are engaged very differently than youth of color and vote differently. And then when you disaggregate young white men from young white women, that can also look somewhat different too. And actually Christians looked at that in some great detail, showing that the how young men, young white men are engaged is actually very different than how youth of color are engaged and some other movement orientations.
What about the gender breakdown? Because we're seeing the gender difference across the board significantly. When you look at young people, I guess maybe that is really my question. Is there a significant gender difference with the young people that you are polling versus what we see nationally where we look at gender as a divergent? And the reason I'm going to say that is that there's always been the gender difference when I ran for governor. It was a gender difference, you know, 10 years before that. There was a gender difference in the 1990s with Hillary Clinton. There's always, in the 2000s. But is there a significant gender difference, not color, but gender, when you're looking at young people? Because I'm trying to figure out how we get to equality. And equality isn't just Asian, Latino, Black, White. It's also men and women.
Yeah, and it's an important point because young Black women and Latinas have been the biggest supporters for the Democratic Party, which is one reason why the Democratic Party spent a lot of time targeting young Black and Latino women in 2018. That's one of the things that we captured in our data. So inevitably, while we haven't released that data yet, inevitably we will see those gender differences. And I think that there'll be gender differences amongst each racial and ethnic subgroup as well.
Right.
And so we haven't posted that data, but I will be absolutely keen on sharing it with you when we do.
Good, good. All right, Christian. So we now know that you looked at young people, but then you also looked at them by Asian, Latino, Black, White. What were the issues that were the greatest motivators, depending on the racial, ethnic difference of the different groups? Was there a different sort of invitation into politics? So if I looked at an African-American young male or female, what was the invitation in for them versus a Caucasian?
For sure. And that's a really good point, Arnie, because as Abby alluded to, young people are very diverse and have all sorts of different lived experiences depending upon the communities they grew up in, where they live in the country, and so on. So for a lot of Black youth in particular, we saw that racism and the police treatment of communities of color were huge issues that really motivated not just their desire to vote and participate in elections, but also their participation in movements such as Black Lives Matter and leadership of those movements as well. And so for young Latinas and Latino men, we saw that immigration and immigration policy in particular were key motivating issues that kind of fueled their civic activism. So yes, there are a whole host of different issues as well that affect young people and that motivate young people to participate in elections and in civic life.
Yeah, Ken, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, can I just ask Abby and Christian what you found motivated the people who were supporting Trump, young people who supported Trump? Because I can't imagine how any person of color would support Trump. But even the white males, you know, you talked about 52% of the white males was all that supported Biden. But if 48%, I'm sure there were a lot of undecideds too. But if some large percentage of white males supported Trump, what's their motivation? What can they be thinking? They can't all be. I don't believe that 40% of young white men are racist. There's got to be something else that's driving them to buy that BS
line.
Yeah.
So what was the attraction? What was the sell? What was the sell, Christian? Why did they check the Trump box?
Well, if you take a look at young white men in particular, there are, again, a whole host of different issues that affect them and that they care about, and that in our poll they listed as a top issue. There isn't necessarily one silver bullet issue that they care about more than anything else. But what we saw for young white men, and particularly young white men who supported Trump, is they cared a lot about the economy and like jobs and getting back to normal after the coronavirus, which was a key issue for them. But there also are a lot of cross-cutting issues as well that young people, no matter their political affiliation, tend to support. For example, there are a lot of young people that are really care about the environment and preventing climate change. That is an issue that while it young Democrats support more, we found that young Trump voters actually break from older Trump voters on that issue and other issues as well. So there are definitely issues of cross-cutting that young people as a whole tend to support more. So it's not to say that like the candidate you support necessarily affects all that is in your lived experience or all that you care about.
Well, you know, Abby, I'm thinking about what Christian had said about sort of the issues that were sort of the defining issues, racism, gun violence with African-American youth, immigration with Latino youth, and then with, I suspect, white young people, and maybe even Asian. I'm not sure what the driver was for Asians, but the idea of climate change and healthcare. So I was thinking about the Latino response and the African-American response. And here's what I think. It's in their face every day. Every day. Climate change ain't in my face every day. Healthcare isn't even in my face. When I'm sick, healthcare is in my face. Or when my parents are sick and they lose their health insurance, it's in my face. Or maybe now because of the pandemic, healthcare may be more in my face. But climate change and healthcare are, how do I say this? This sounds awful. But they're almost like luxury issues. Because I don't live climate change in the immediacy of the moment. I don't necessarily even live healthcare in the immediacy of the moment unless I'm sick. But when you talk about issues like immigration, and when you talk about issues like racism and police violence, for the African-American community and the Hispanic community, that's front and center a lot. Am I right? So it's not like they don't care about climate change or they don't care about healthcare. This is their lived experience.
Well, and I think there's a racial justice angle to all of the issues that we're talking about, access to healthcare, when we talk about climate justice.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, and so I think that, you know, for different communities, these things can be very in your face. And it really differs by community, by neighborhood that you're in. You know, maybe it's one of the neighborhoods that a highway was built through it in order to deliberately segregate, you know.
Yeah.
And so this is just another example of why the experiences, as Christian said, the experiences that young people have really can manifest engagement through the support that a young person has, or really deter them from engagement. And so this is one of the other things in the poll that we have been learning about is, you know, the ramifications of being in a pandemic during an election cycle and the access that various young people have about how do I vote? How do I register to vote in this context? And unfortunately, the access to that information remains unequal amongst young people and, you know, continues to reiterate some of the political inequalities that we have.
So here's what I want you to do. I want you to do a poll of 45-year-olds, 55-year-olds, 65-year-olds. We have no freaking clue either. No. I'm going to say that because it is changing by the hour. Last year I couldn't vote absentee. This year I can vote absentee because this year COVID-19 or the fear of contracting it is now considered a disability. That wasn't true last year. I had to actually have a disability or I had to be out of state. So the problem for young people is that one, they're new to this.
Right.
Even us old farts who have never missed an election, it is a moving target. It is going to change even within a month before the election, because what's happening with the pandemic, what's happening with voter suppression, what's happening with the USPS, all these things are going to make it different. And what I'm hoping that young people realize is in a lot of ways, they're better off than me because they know how to maneuver in social media. They know how to have that instant gratification and instant contact. Psst, you hear what? Me, what website do I go to? How do I turn on my computer? What social media? So in a lot of ways, I get that they don't know. What I think is so exciting is if there's the right network, they can learn more faster than people of my demographic, Christina. And I understand that they need to know, mm-hmm. but I hate to break it to you. I don't want to give them bad information because what we know today may not be what we know in September.
Precisely. And we need young people to know where to go to get that information. And yes. we need the networks that you referred to be built now, right?
Yes.
They need to be built like, you know, a couple of months
yes.
ago.
yeah.
And that's why, you know, what campaigns are doing and what local youth organizations are doing on the ground right now is absolutely critical.
Absolutely. Well, we need a TikTok. No, no,
yeah,
I'm dead
exactly.
No. All right, no, Christian, start planning a TikTok about voting. This is the Georgia TikTok. This is a Florida TikTok. I mean, I saw what happened in Tulsa. I love TikTok. I don't even know what it is, but I love it. You know, but that shows you this is my sort of head in the sand mentality. I don't know anything, but I'm jealous of its capacity. Now, the one thing I want to do before I let you go, this is so much fun because it's everything I've been fighting for my whole life. So I love the two of you. Youth in the Streets. Tell us a little bit about that engagement this year compared to what we've seen in the past. To me, that I think is a huge change in behavior, Christian.
Absolutely. So one of the key differentiators of the activism and the engagement this cycle as compared to maybe in the past is that we see young people not just participating in movements, but also at the helm of movements. So it's young people who are speaking at these marches and demonstrations, young people who are doing the organizing work. And that, of course, breaks down very differently by race and by gender as well. So as Abby mentioned, oftentimes it's young women of color who are leading the charge on these fronts. And it's so important that young people are leading these movements, because when other young people see young people making a difference and front and center and in media and represented in like the national discourse, that motivates other young people to want to participate as well. So it's really cool to see young people doing a lot of the work and reaching out on platforms that are native to them as well. You mentioned TikTok, for example. A lot of young people are talking about the election and reaching out to other young people and getting them inspired to engage because they're using networks that are native to them. And so oftentimes for like campaigns and policymakers, instead of like telling young people what to do, they should meet young people where they are and recognize all of the amazing work young people are doing.
Well, let me just quote from your survey. 27% of young people ages 18 to 24 say they have attended a march or demonstration, a remarkable increase from when we asked the question for the same age group before the 2016 and 2018 elections. In 2016, that percentage, 5%. In 2018, that percentage, 18%. Let me repeat the first number, 27%. I want a billboard. I want a freaking billboard. That is just amazing. And you're absolutely right. If they see young people, we saw that with Parkland. What a great influence those students. I got to actually be a moderator of a panel with two Parkland students. The electricity in the room of, it was at Rhode Island College, of all the young students to see people their age, engage with them, having engaged at the national level, having gone to, you know, speak to governors and speak to presidents and take their issues way beyond Florida was so exciting, because not only did they have this horrific experience, but they were able to show that they could take that experience and those voices and begin to affect change. And it wasn't just about Florida anymore. It was about those young people in that room in Providence, Rhode Island, that was so exciting. And I can remember when I ran for governor in 1992, I remember thinking, if I can't see it, can I imagine? And I was the first female to run for governor in 1992. I remember when I lost, here's the question I was asked, like, what's your greatest regret? And I said, I have a regret that I lost, but I have hope. Women didn't lose in 1992. Only Arnie lost in 1992. And that's really important, because I wanted other women to pick up the charge and run. And you know what? Virtually every single woman that ran after me did win. So again, that's what's exciting for young people, is to see the AOCs of this world and realize what the potential is for, you know, someone saying, I'm gonna take on an institution and I'm gonna bring it to the people. And not only that, but she won her primary this time by what, 70% of the vote? I mean, she wasn't a one-off in 2018. She was an investment in our future. So I am incredibly grateful that you did this. You have to get back to me when you continue to crunch these numbers.
Will
because
do.
They're too important. And again, I want to remind everyone that CIRCLE means the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. It is a nonpartisan independent research organization focused on youth civic engagement in the United States. I am thrilled with the numbers that you came up with. Abby Kirsa is the Director of Impact, and Christian Lundberg is an Associate Researcher at CIRCLE. Thank you both so much for joining us. Keep up the good work. And actually, the good part is you're not doing the good work. The young people are. You just get to notice.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Ciao, you guys.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, everyone, stick around. One of my faves is coming up next. He writes for Slate.com. Bob Henley. We'll be right then.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day thousands of Pullman strikers confronted state militia forces at the Grand Trunk Railroad crossing in Chicago. The strike began on May 11th after George Pullman slashed wages but refused to lower rents in his company town. In late June, Eugene V. Debs and the American Railway Union called for a national boycott of all Pullman cars. The boycott spread to 27 states, involving more than 150,000 workers. Attorney General Richard Olney issued an injunction declaring the strike illegal on July 2nd. The injunction failed to break the strike, but it did prevent union leaders from communicating with strikers. The next day, President Cleveland ordered troops into Chicago rail yards to crush the strike. Workers were furious. They flooded the yards, stopping trains, smashing switches, and barricading themselves with baggage cars. Fighting continued for several days as angry strikers stormed rail yards and overturned empty freight cars. Thousands of workers impacted by the Depression joined in, including those stranded in the city after the Columbian Exposition. Two strikers were shot dead on the Illinois Central Railroad on July 6th. Workers responded by setting fire to hundreds of rail cars. Now, on this day, the militia attempted to run a work train to clear the rail yard at 49th and Loomis. Thousands followed followed the train, showering it with bricks and stones. The troops returned gunfire, killing at least four and injuring dozens. Chicago unions soon voted in favor of a citywide sympathy strike, but the railroads quickly hired replacement labor. Federal troops and state militia cleared the railway for business. Maine strike leaders were arrested. By the beginning of August, Pullman rehired only those strikers who agreed to never join a union. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. He's a regular. He writes for InsiderNJ.com. He writes for The Chief Leader. He writes for Salon.com. You can find him at Stuck Nation. Who am I referring to? None other than Robert Hennelly, otherwise referred to as Bob. His most recent piece at Salon.com, I just told him just before he came on the air, I think is one of his best. Here is the title. As COVID-19 deaths hit record numbers, Trump oversees a historic wealth transfer to the super rich. As usual, communities of color are hit hardest by the economic collapse overseen by Trump and his fellow oligarchs. Welcome to the program, Bob. This is one of your best pieces. It is one of the most depressing, I will tell you frankly. And as I mentioned to you and to Ken, I kept pulling out little sort of facts from your article and posting it on Facebook. I called one COVID math. I'm doing all this stuff because I want people to not only see the nuggets first, but once they see that, then connect it to your article because you put it together in such a powerful and frustrating way. So why don't you sort of begin at the beginning, because this is not a new phenomenon. We've seen it happen before, but now because so many of us are stuck at home, we can't socialize. Some of us can't go to work. Some of us are dying because we are going to work. I think this story is really important because it's not just a motivator to begin to really look at economic justice, but it's really a great motivator for November of 2020.
Well, thanks. I think that this has to do with the fact that just like with human beings, a pandemic and a mass death event captures society as they were or as we are living. So all of the things that were baked into our regular lives are present when we're thrown into crisis. So if you're about to have a coronary and you realize you're gonna go to the other side, as they say, you think about that extra hamburger you had. You think about all the excesses of your life that brought you to that sorry circumstance of leaving the earth so prematurely. And so that's kind of what's been happening in the United States. Our current circumstance is the consequence of a reckless disregard for the circumstance of the American people that what I can trace back roughly maybe to the 1970s. And this is when we had that famous split, which you've spoken about so often, where wages failed to keep pace with productivity. We saw labor unions decline in their influence and power. And it was just impossible for families to make ends meet. We saw it getting to a hyper level just towards the end of so-called recovery of the Great Recession, where we were all very encouraged by the election of President Obama, who were so nostalgic for his grace and charisma. And yet the reality, the sad reality, is that even as he presided over the United States with all that professorial dignity, the circumstance of American people continued to deteriorate, specifically African-American households who, while they celebrated the fact that one of their own had achieved the White House, so many millions of them lost their own house. Then we enter into COVID, and we've had 3 years of life decline for average Americans leading into COVID. So we were indeed set up for where we are right now.
So, you know, I'm thinking about this, and you mentioned you go back to the 1970s, and you've heard me say this before, but it's an absolute, something else hit me as you were talking about it. So I've always said that, you know, we saw the loss of manufacturing jobs, we saw the decline in incomes in the 1970s, but it was okay, even though they didn't reduce our mortgage, they didn't reduce the family food bill, they didn't reduce the cost of cars, we had a spouse who could go into the workforce, because it was also the beginning of the women's movement, and you saw more and more women enter the workforce. And then I always said that by the 1980s, the two incomes weren't enough to replace what had been lost. And then we needed a ménage à trois. And so we would have, like, your kid might have to, like, get a part-time job. But today, here's the kicker. It's one person having three jobs. Not the three people in the family working. It's one person working one job and then working another job and working another job. Yeah, they're working. Who was designed to work 60 hours a week at three different jobs?
Well, and I
and yet that's the horror of it. It isn't that you needed another warm body. This warm body was working multiple jobs in order to, quote unquote, continue to maybe pay the bills. But as you point out, we're one paycheck away from, like, you know, a $400, you know, cash that we have on hand, and that won't pay a medical bill, let alone a car accident, let alone a loss of job.
Well, and I think we neglected to include in our household inventory the secret interloper known as household debt.
Yes.
That was a partner given to us so that we could begin to think we had the same circumstance as our parents, because we could go on the trip to Disney just like mom and dad did. We could buy the new car every other year just like mom and dad did. But we were all doing it on borrowed money, or we found any number of ways to sell out the equity in our homes while we live deeper and deeper in debt. And at the same time, our national government, our state government, local government, and independent power utilities and authorities were doing the same thing.
Oh, God, it's, a, you know, when you tell it this way, you just want to pull your hair out. I mean, I go back to think about, like, the first car I owned and what I had as an income. And then I look at the car that I have now, and I look at my income, and I'm going, we're freaking nuts. I mean, people are paying $27,000, $30,000 for a car, and that's like an average price, you know, in the 20s. And I'm thinking, but you're making 35 grand. You're making 40,000. That's half your income for a year on your car.
Right.
That was not what it was supposed to be, you know? And yet that's what it is, because, as you point out, debt and credit is how we survive. It's not based on the income in and the income out. It's based on being an indentured servant for the next 40 years.
Right. And I think this system was given to us in a bipartisan betrayal, and it's very important. And I'm going to make sure to fill out my New Jersey primary ballot. Deb and I are going to go out and proudly drop it off and keep an eye on it. We might even keep an eye on it for 24 hours to see if it gets collected. But the reality is that we didn't get here by some, like, natural disaster. This was a response to economic policies that included subsidizing multinational corporations that were started in this country, being able to be supported economically through tax code to move their operations offshore. And this happened for decades. And it didn't matter who was presiding in the White House. It could be Bush. It could be Clinton. It could be Obama. Right. Now, nominally, it's true that you do have labor issues raised in a progressive way by the Democratic Party, but all too often, labor itself has been taken for granted by the Democratic Party.
Right. Well, and let's be honest, I think that thing that's been so interesting is that while the Democrats mouth concern about all these jobs moving offshore, but then you begin to look at some of the NAFTA policies,
right,
and you look at some of the other policies that both Democrats and Republicans supported, you realize they aided and abetted. But here's the difference. Republicans were so clever. What they said is, oh, your jobs abandoned you? It's the immigrants' fault.
Right.
So they got to take, they didn't absorb the heat of supporting these trade deals that sent jobs abroad. They got to point to an immigrant and say, that's your problem. Not right. The CEO, not the company. And the Democrats said nothing. They right. said nothing. They weren't going to blame the immigrant. That's not how they act. They right. weren't going to support unions because they just didn't. But they were kind of quiet, Bob. And in their quiet, who filled that vacuum but the Republican Party with, you know, why is this way? And they were able to direct the anger and the frustration against people of color, against undocumented immigrants, against legal immigrants, whoever it was, because that was phenomenal for them, because they didn't have to then own the fact that they had been aiding and abetting the wealthy management and CEOs in making their decisions that was maybe good for their bottom line, but not good for jobs.
The Democrats were quiet because who funds them? Who are their donors? Their donors on Wall Street. Their donors are big corporations. Their donors are the same.
They bought their silence.
That donate to the Republicans.
Yeah, I would say that one of the things also that was happening at the same time was post 9/11, our national imagination was captured and subverted by how we dealt with the perceived global threat to our well-being.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I remember as a practicing journalist, right around, I'd say, 1999 and 2000, the conversation was, what are we going to do with the peace dividend from detente? What are we going to do with the fact that we beat the USSR? And very quickly, what was formulated was something that filled all that space and more, where we really had, and I think the failure of the House and the Senate to hold Trump accountable, our dictator, is a consequence of the institutional weakness that these bodies showed when they were unable to hold anyone accountable for these failed wars that have drained the treasury and really created a lost opportunity cost for doing the things we really need to do that are upon us, like pandemic preparation and like global warming.
Let me remind everyone, we're talking with Bob Hennelly. His piece at Slate.com is entitled, As COVID-19 Deaths Hit Record Numbers, Trump Oversees a Historic Wealth Transfer to the Super Rich. Subtext, as usual, communities of color are hit hardest by the economic collapse overseen by Trump and his fellow oligarchs. Well, we haven't gotten to the actual beginning of your headline. That is the transfer of wealth to the super rich. So let me just share from your fabulous piece. I almost wanted you just to read the damn thing out loud because it's kind of like everyone is, oh God, that sentence, that paragraph. But here's one of my faves. An analysis from the Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality documented, sit down everyone, in the span of 3 months, write this down, the US added 29 more billionaires, while 45.5 million people filed for unemployment. So in 3 months, during a freaking pandemic, when people were being told to shelter in place, when people were told to work from home, when their kids couldn't go to school, when people who were at greatest risk were being sent to the meatpacking facilities to die of COVID, we added 29 more billionaires. That is frickin' disgusting, Robert.
Yeah. And I think it's accelerating. And one of the things that has happened is that when you're in, it's almost getting to the point of like a gravitational pull. So the more that folks have, the more they're going to get as the world turns.
Right.
And in periods of time of crisis like this, and it's really unprecedented, people are in this distress mode because you've had the contraction of employment opportunities. So what's just crazy, all of that talk that was happening when New York was in the, and New Jersey were in the throes of the pandemic, we were talking about the premium pay for essential workers. You remember that not so oldie goodie?
Yeah.
We want to give to those who are giving so much to us in our hour of national need. You put a lawn sign out front, and of course, what's happening is they're rolling back the premium pay. And in reality, under Donald Trump's depression, wages are going down, sports fans. They're going down.
Tell them the nugget that's in your piece. I'm desperately looking for it right now.
It's like, 20, it's like 20 to 40 cents down per hour, depending on the position. Right.
Yes. So here they are. Here they are working, dying, not being protected with the right PPEs, doing what we call the essential worker. We're going to clap for them, and we're going to sing music to them. But not only are they going into a situation where they could potentially die, not only are they not getting the support they need in order to make them safe, but on top of that, an insult to injury, their incomes are declining.
Right.
Hourly earnings for private non-farm payroll shrank by 35 cents
Thank
an
you.
Hour.
Thank you. Found it. You found it.
Supervisory workers lost 20%.
So this is a sorry. And meanwhile, what you get for your misery and your consciousness is the stock market repeated at the bottom and top of the hour, along with your COVID death count.
Yeah.
That's the worldview. And so you want to know who's benefiting from the gyrations of the stock market after the Great Recession. It's a much smaller percentage of the American people. And so even our debate is framed, not including this stuff, which is a real way of getting people motivated and angry. So wherever I go, and I think people need to do this, we need to talk to each other, and we need to force the conversations that the corporate media doesn't want us to have. And we do that by exercising solidarity wherever we encounter people in these retail settings, and ask them and be concerned for them. Are you still getting your premium pay?
Yeah,
and then have the conversation, because you could, as long as we're required to wear masks, they should be getting their premium pay.
Well, you know, and let's add to this conversation. So we hear our racist in chief, you know, at Mount Rushmore, and then in D.C., and he's coming to Portsmouth on Saturday, bringing his racist segregation, you know, destroying our great American history, as he says. But one of the things I keep thinking about is, and he is basically, he's a COVID spreader. Okay, that's what he is. Every setting he comes into, people think that they can't wear a mask because it shows that they're not supporting him. People think they shouldn't social distance because they're not supporting him. So community spread is really what he's spreading. That's not what he is.
Right.
It's not just racism. He's spreading community spread. And what is so shocking is that you realize we keep talking about how you want your doctor when you're sick, and how Obama lied to you that the Affordable Care Act was going to ensure that you have a doctor. Your doctor's going to die because of Donald Trump. Your nurse is going to die. You want a doctor? You may not have a doctor.
Right.
You know, and doctors are losing their jobs because we have more specialists than any country in the world, and we're not doing any of the specialties now because every hospital bed is being occupied, especially in big places like Houston, Texas, and in Florida, with COVID patients. Well, when COVID patients take over your hospital, all the specialty doctors are moot. Because suddenly what it is you're trying to keep people breathing and alive. I mean, it is what is going on in Houston, which is the largest hospital complex in the world, is that they're running out of beds.
Right.
And Texas is still in la-la land with their lieutenant governor basically saying, you know, you have an obligation to kind of get COVID and die.
Right.
And I'm thinking, really? You better talk to some doctors and nurses who are going to go with them.
Not to mention that losing their job means that the people have no insurance to pay for their health care. So even if they had a doctor to go to, they couldn't pay for it because they don't have health insurance anymore.
Exactly.
And I do think that part of this is that, and this isn't discussed, but I do believe that Donald Trump still ascribes to the herd immunity approach, which is very popular in these right-wing circles. We know that it almost killed Boris Johnson. And so they do believe, and it's kind of like a Malthusian fatalism, right? That best to burn through it, that the young will survive. None of it's science-based. If anything, we're finding out that this disease is not fully understood. They don't know to what degree antibody, there's been some documentation that this plasma treatment can help people recover, but there's no clear understanding of what antibodies or any kind of immunities may exist as a consequence of getting it. And the other thing that's largely missed by the reporting, and I'm hearing this because I covered the civil service with some granular attention to detail, people returning after being cleared by their doctors only to be discovered that they have a long-term disability issue. Cases like a court officer in New York City who ended up having an arm amputated as a result of blood clots, respiratory issues. So we're going to see an entire class, I mean, in the thousands upon thousands of individuals who will be permanently disabled by this disease. And so the notion that at the same time the Trump administration and the GOP are trying to get rid of that very lifeline, which is a pre-existing condition, it really makes you think that this would be the course of action of an enemy power in control of the White House.
No, I mean, he is more lethal than any atomic bomb. He is more lethal than a war. I mean, when you begin to realize the number of people who have died, when you realize that virtually from whether it's undermining testing, whether it's giving contracts or PPEs, there was a story in the front page of the Concord Monitor the other day where some guy ordered PPEs. And what he got was he got these like plastic, you know, whatever they wear over their clothing. And there was no place for their arms. They were sealed. So they couldn't put their hands through, okay? I mean, the level of defective, the level of what's going on, the lies about the 99% that he said that are gonna, you know, contract COVID and be perfectly fine. I mean, he just makes stuff up. But what he's not making up is that people are dying and the economy is tanking.
Right.
And what we haven't done, Bob, which I think is so important, is that, you know, MSNBC and CNN and all those cable stations that are not Fox, every day should do a segment on what it's like in a country that understood leadership, that right. understood what they needed to do with the shutdown, that understood how to literally stop the spread completely, where they're literally going back to eat, where they're going back to school, where their lives have returned to like 90% of what it was like before. So it is possible. But the opposite has happened here. We think that our experience is universal, and it is not.
Right. Right. Oh. And that national centricity is something that's developed over a long time, where we have a presumption of a superiority to the world, despite actual hard evidence to the contrary.
Right. Exactly.
And to some degree, this self-flattery has been a construct that has existed in the post-World War II environment as a bedrock of most of the reporting we've consumed. Only now are you beginning to see some awareness that we are really in a third world status, despite all our hubris.
So Robert Henley, it's not only the idea of the self-flattery. If you read the historic texts, we've been lying to ourselves forever.
Yep.
I mean, that's the story of Black Lives Matter. You know, that's the story of Juneteenth. That's all the stories that we don't know. All the Confederate statues that we have, but not the statues to the lynchings that were done. You know, I mean, I remember interviewing the guy who ran the first museum to slavery ever in the United States. It was opened in Louisiana, and people have been talking about it. Finally, a white lawyer got so upset that he did it on his own. The first museum ever in the United States happened within the last 3 or 4 years. Right. And it took some frustrated white lawyer to actually make it happen because no state, no federal government wanted to even acknowledge it. Instead, we celebrate Robert E. Lee, but we didn't celebrate the failure of this nation from its very beginning and its origins. Robert Henley, I adore you. Everyone needs to read this piece.
Love you
too. Really is so powerful, so full of great numbers that you need to take to the bank. And I mean the voting bank. Again, the title is, As COVID-19 Deaths Hit Record Numbers, Trump Oversees a Historic Wealth Transfer to the Super Rich. Robert Henley is an investigative reporter at the Chief Leader, InsiderNJ.com, and a columnist at Salon.com. We'll talk to you soon, I promise.
Talk to you next time.
All right, ciao.
Yeah, this was is, fun. Thanks, yeah, John.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
I stand too close to the fire and brush off the sparks as they fall. The headaches and cough say I'd be better off working at no job at all. But the kids' college just burns money. We pay off the bills as they fall. So who foots the bill when they padlock the mill and we stand at the gate with our backs to the wall? Something's dying. This is crazy. A town goes down, you don't stand and watch. It's a house on fire. It's a kid down a well. Sound a siren. Headlights blazing. Say a prayer or a curse. Lend a hand or a fist. But don't sit there and watch it go down. Something's dying. The Pratt farm grew and it rained down loans. Then the bankers declared a drought. Ain't that the way? Work hard every day and farm till the money runs out. Each year gets harder, they live off the garden and all the pride they can swallow. Third crow of the cock, it goes on the block. Tractors and mason jars dime on the dollar. Something's dying. Bertha's made chocolate for 30 years. She runs that plant on swing shift. She doesn't sleep as long or as well as the family that owns the business. But business is business, family is family. They sold to the bottom line house. The new junior exec and some Pinkerton hack just gave Bertha 10 minutes to get off the ground. Something's dying. I remember this town when it rolled out the steel, proud of its smell and its smoke. Then oil wells and malls called the smart money south, and the banks were the last to go broke. I remember this town when songs flowed like beer, dancing would bring up the sun. Now the nights are as dry as a cheap fifth of rye. You can't sell your house, the kids are all gone. Something's dying. Makes me crazy. A life goes down, you don't stand and watch. It's a house on fire. It's a kid down a well. Sound the siren. Headlights blazing. Say a prayer or a curse. Lend a hand or a fist. But don't sit there and watch it go down. Something's dying.